うん。
Good afternoon. We have judiciary before us, and I'd like us to take roll call, please. Excused. Here. Thank you very much. Justice Kite, it's welcome to JAC.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you'd do us a favor and introduce your other members and staff so that we have new members and they kind of get familiarized with the process. You're our first group to hear from during the session, and maybe just give us a slight overview and then just start with your exceptional request.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will do that. Mr. Chairman and Madam Chairman, our representatives from the Supreme Court today, we have the entire court here, as well as the our staff, which are Joanne Odendahl, our court administrator, who you will be hearing the most from, I can guarantee you, and Rhonda Munger, our deputy administrator. With me also here today are Justice Golden in the back, Justice Hill, Justice Burke, and Justice Hoyt. Also, we have District Judge Tom Campbell. And I think that's it. Judge Campbell is from here in the First Judicial District, and he has an issue to address when we're finished with the Supreme Court budget supplemental budget request. Am I missing anybody? No. And also, we also have Stephen Dreher, who is our IT manager. Many of you know and have worked with him. If any questions come up with in that regard, God knows I'm not going to answer them, so we will have Stephen. We have a very, hopefully, short, sweet request. I know that the supplemental budgets are the exception and not the rule, and we come only because we think it is an important request. It involves giving us the tools that we need to better manage the circuit judges or circuit court system, which is made up of both the circuit judges and the circuit court clerks. And we're asking for money to do an additional time study to make sure that we have the right information on the workload of those circuit court clerks. It fits into our current effort to try to run our system efficiently. We are, and Joanne can talk more about this, but we are trying to make sure that we're not overloaded with clerks where we don't need to be and where we're staffed properly, moving them around properly. To do that, we've got to have a good handle on what their workload is and how much time they spend on individual matters. It's a small request of $80,000 for this upcoming year, and Joanne can tell you how that fits into our long-term program, but we're obviously here to answer any questions you may have that may go beyond that. But with that little brief introduction, I will turn it over to Joanne Odendahl.
Ms. Odendahl?
Thank you, Chief Justice Kite. Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, I would like to explain to the new members a little bit about our budget, if I can. You will notice.
Can you move your speaker up closer to you, please?
There we go. Can you hear me now? We do have a separate branch budget from the executive branch. All of the district court budgets will be included with the Supreme Court budget. And as we go through here, if I can have you turn to the Supreme Court page 1 under the Supreme Court section, I would like to point out that there is a memo to you all from the Chief Justice. That memo always is always in the front of the Supreme Court budget, making recommendations for any requests from the circuit courts, our law library, all of the divisions within the Supreme Court. And under the district court section, under page 1 of the district court, you will see a memo to you all from the district judges budget review committee. Again, I point these out to you because the judges come to you with their recommendations from the judicial branch, and you will not see a letter from the governor making recommendations on the judicial branch as you work your budgets. Going on to page 6, I do want to point out again in the left-hand column all of the divisions under the Supreme Court. The items in blue that you see are the supplemental budget requests. That's what you have approved in the last biennium session. We do color code our work throughout this request so that it's easier for you to kind of pick out the most important information. There's a lot of information in black that, you know, you can read if you certainly have time to do so. What's the supplemental budget is always in blue, and then in the brown is all of the supplemental or the standard budget is in blue, the supplemental is in brown. Those items, I hope, stand out to you. The numbers correlate with all of the narrative that you will see as we go through this. Turning on to page, well, one thing I do want to point out, excuse me, Madam Chair, on page 6, you will notice our request for $80,000. It is a time study in our circuit courts for the circuit court clerks. However, it's not listed in the Circuit Court Division because of the nature of that request. We do put it in our administrative budget of the Supreme Court.
Why did you stick it in your 100 series as opposed to a, which I assume if you, did you intend for it to go in the 100 series to biennialize it, or is it going to be one time, or?
No, the one, it's not a 100 series, Madam Chair. Basically, that's our Division 100. And as we turn to page 9, you can see that the $80,000, the administration division, the 100 program, so to speak, division, we are asking for $80,000 in the 903, the professional fees. That is a one-time budget request that will drop out in the next budget session. Giving you a little bit of information, though, you should have received a handout. It's very colorful. Okay, this $80,000, now I've got them all, $80,000 to do the time study is basically, as Chief Justice Kite indicated, a tool that we work with. So when judges come to us and ask for additional personnel, they're not just automatically in our budget request to you all. We sit back and we look at this tool that has been devised, has been working for the last 10 or 12 years. And the last, it's been a few years since we actually did a time study, which requires our circuit court clerks to take approximately 2 months, and They go through and on a daily basis keep track of 10-minute intervals on a two-month period. All of that information is put in a database depending on what type of cases they're working on. For instance, if you look in the blue column, the case weight in minutes, that information that the clerks put together on a 10-minute interval, some cases may take longer. Citations, inputting citations is a very quick process. Sometimes processing garnishments in civil cases might take a little bit longer. Putting on civil cases may take a little bit longer. But in order to get a good determination of what it takes for a circuit court clerk to do certain processes, this is the tool we use. As we go through here, for instance, in Laramie County District 1, they may have had 763 small claims cases. Basically, on average, it takes a circuit court clerk 69 minutes to process that case. Now, it may be that in one day they've only processed a garnishment. It may be on another day they've input that case into the case management system. But collectively, that particular case took that clerk 69 minutes to process. Now, it may be different in smaller courts versus the larger courts. In the larger courts, we have enough employees, the processes are streamlined. The smaller courts, maybe one or two clerks, have to be able to go from interruptions from telephone calls, maybe a citation case that they're taking a payment on, back to a civil case. So a little bit more time may take place in the smaller courts. But all of that information from all of the courts is put together in a minimum, or excuse me, an average for those minutes comes into play. As you go down this workload study, and I'm going to turn this over to Rhonda Munger because Rhonda can explain this inside and out, and maybe answer a few more questions and explain it for you.
Madam Chairman, part of the reason we need to do a time study, and usually we do it on an average of 5 to 6 years. The last time we studied the judges was 2007. It was 2005 when we last studied the clerks. And each year we plug in the filing numbers, and that's what you see in the first column if you go down in Laramie County. They had 763 small claims cases, 4,714 civil cases, et cetera. We only do the time study every so often. First of all, it's very time-consuming for the clerks to take out for 2 months and measure every minute that they spend working on different cases. But then each year, we plug in the new filing numbers to those case weights, and that's how we come up with the workload. We haven't done the clerk's workload since 2005, as I mentioned, but, for example, in family violence cases, we measured them in 2005, but in 2006, the legislature changed the law to allow for protection orders to go up to a year instead of just 90 days, which is what they were before. So when we measured the clerks on those cases, the law was different. And now we believe it takes them more time because you do some custody, you do some child support. If it's going to be a year protection order, which is what is allowed, it takes more time to ferret those issues out. So that's why we believe it's time to do a new study. And that's just one example.
With respect to the $80,000, how do you expect to spend it? I mean, are you going to hire a consultant, or is this just extra IT work for you? Or
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we do hire a consultant. She has been doing the studies for both the judges and the circuit court clerks for the last 10 years. She does provide us the expertise to, she's a statistician and has a staff that takes all of the data that is put together, compiled by our clerks, and inputs that information. So we do not at this time have the staff to do this. We do, after the time study, Rhonda takes our statistics after every fiscal year and inputs that data and updates the actual assessment. As you can see on the bottom of this spreadsheet, if you go to the last page, you can see that we currently have 125 clerk positions. It also indicates that we have seven clerks overstaffed. Our seven clerks within our circuit courts overstaffed. We have four vacant positions at this time, and we do not plan to fill those vacancies because of the fact this assessment tool indicates that they did not need that position. So as the vacancy occurred, we're leaving it vacant. We have used one vacancy to hire a clerk who acts as a rover for us, travels throughout the state to help the courts that are short-staffed, and so that we keep on track of all of our cases and keep up to date as much as possible. We have a situation in Crook and Weston where one court, after a vacancy, was short a half a person. The other court was over a half a person. Since they share the same judge, we have the ability to use a circuit court half-time in one court and half in the other. We're trying to use our resources as most efficiently as possible. But the only way we can do that and continue to do that is to continue to update the time study based on all of the changes of the laws that have come into play, laws that will come into play in the next year or 2 years. So this is the tool that we use.
Sure. With respect to the narrative on page 9, you've got an assessment there with respect to using it to determine who's overstaffed and understaffed. Do you have a component that begins to look just efficiencies, and that is how to do it better throughout? Are you looking, saying, look, some courts do this work more quickly and better than other courts?
Madam Co-Chair, we do look at that. Actually, our rover clerk, as she is going out and working within the circuit courts, she's realizing some courts are working efficiently, and obviously some don't do the same type of processes. Now, that does come into play because we have every circuit court clerk keeping track of their time, and it's an average. Obviously, some of the courts who have, say, 13 or 14 people, those clerks can be specialized. They can standardize their process and move things more efficiently through their system. Again, the smaller courts, because of the interruptions and the variety of cases that two people may have to take care of, that process may take a little bit longer.
With respect to the electronic filing, do you have any clerks that are doing electronic filing, or is it all still paper at this level, at the circuit court level?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, right now we do not have any e-filing in our circuit court system, and Chief Justice Kite will make mention to that tomorrow in her State of the State. That is something that we're ready to go with. Our IT staff has been preparing software whenever they get the go-ahead from the Highway Patrol, the state's sheriff's offices and local law enforcement, but at this time we do not have e-citations. We do have e-payments, which all of a sudden is happening in the last week. Taking a credit card within the circuit court system is a very time-consuming process for our clerks, but again, we're trying to save time, save money, and get more money into the court in an easier way. So that is in pilot, and again, Chief Justice Kite will mention that tomorrow in her State of Judiciary.
Chairman, I think I sort of had in my mind that two different things, e-citation being part of the commission to try to make a seamless transition so when the officer plugs in the citation, it's electronic from there all the way through the time it hits your court system, and then separately the issue of whether or not you're going to electronic filing for your civil matters and your non-civils. Are you making any progress on, I guess the question on the e-citation, is it working? Are we saving time? And then are we moving towards any of the courts with respect to having the entire system electronic?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, we have finished electronic filing in the Supreme Court. We are about halfway through in the district courts and hope to be finished with that by the end of next year, I think. Right, Stephen? Our plan is then to go to the circuit courts and establish electronic filing in the circuit courts. So right now there is essentially no electronic filing in the circuit courts. E-citations is just getting off the ground, and I do plan to talk about this a little bit tomorrow. But the Highway Patrol has, I think they actually did this with federal money, they have gotten their system up and will be ready to go sometime by midsummer, we're hoping. Our system is ready to take that electronic citation information, and that is going to be tremendous in terms of workload and efficiency once we're able to do that. Payment by credit card is also just barely getting started. In fact, I think it was this week was the first time in Laramie County, and they've done this with their current for and pay the fine. So we're just on the cutting edge of that. Mr. Co-Chairman, but we are not yet, we certainly aren't beyond Laramie County. The ability to swipe the driver's license is going to be a huge step forward, too, but that is something that law enforcement is going to need additional funding to get those items in place. So electronic filing, we're about halfway finished. We'll be asking you probably next year for funds to finish that in the circuit courts. E-citations, we are on the cusp of getting that underway with the Highway Patrol this year. And electronic payments in the same fashion. So we're certainly not there yet, but it is striking. One week after I got this job, I went to the Chief Justice Conference, and when you hear, we're way ahead of some states, but we're also way behind others. And in the states that have this electronic age in place in their judiciary, they can, you know, essentially literally swipe a driver's license and the money goes in and goes out to all the proper places and doesn't touch a human hand. So we're a long ways from that, but we recognize the benefits of getting there and we're working hard to go in that direction.
With respect to the where your clerk has gone electronic, are you finding that they do more work now electronic or are they getting less done because it's complicated? Part of the issue is, are we really saving staff, or are we just creating more complex work for existing staff?
Well, I'm going to let Joanne and Rhonda address this also, Madam Chairman, excuse me. We're such a small operation in the Supreme Court. We have, you know, essentially about 300 or 400 cases a year. I think it's safe to say that they are able to work much more efficiently. People can access the information much more easily where they can just do it on our website. We don't have the volume of work that you're going to have in a district court or a circuit court. So I can't say at this stage that electronic filing in our clerk's office has saved positions. I can say that I think they're operating more efficiently and the public is much better served as a result of the electronic filing in the Supreme Court. If I may,
anything to add? With respect to e-payment and credit cards, that ties into confidentiality. I mean, how are you making sure that information that's confidential maintains confidentiality and the e-payment side of it on the security issues? Are we, do we have a good system so we know that credit card numbers and things like that are going to be made private?
Madam Chairman, Stephen, we can ask Stephen Dreher to address that. He is our guru in that area.
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, the answer to that question is that electronic payments are really two components. There is the component that the public sees, which we're all familiar with through traditional avenues like PayPal or the normal payment transaction. And then there's the second, or the behind-the-scenes payment transaction, which actually occurs with the payment gateway or the financial institution itself. To answer the Senator Nicholas's question, yes, it is secure. Both the communications between our organization and the clearing company or the payment gateway is encrypted. All the credit card numbers are secured, as well as the confirmation of that transaction. So we actually have to follow through that, making sure that a receipt is generated, that the receipt can go to the court, that the clerk makes note of that in the case management system.
The person paying by fine pays an extra fee so that everybody pays the same same amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify on, in your verbiage on page 9, you do say that the last one of these surveys was done in 07. That was circuit court clerks. Last time circuit court clerks was conducted was 07. What is this one then?
Court position in 07. But the actual study, the time study, and the measuring of the minutes was done in 2005. And then each year, we do a new edition of the weighted workload, which is what we call this. Every 5 or 6 years, we do the time study, which is the blue column. And the case weights get redone in a time study. But the workload we generate every year, and we plug in the new fiscal year filings to come up with what happens each year and how busy they are in each court. Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, that's all we have, unless there's any other additional questions.
Any other questions, committee? Okay. Go ahead, Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm new to this committee, so I may not have the institutional memory, and this may be something that's common knowledge to everybody else, but I'm wondering if this is a study that you do periodically, why it wasn't included in your budget when we did the regular budget last year.
Madam Chair, to be honest with you, when we have to start preparing our biennium budget, we are 6 months before the budget session even starts. At that point in time, we did not even have an idea of some of the changes that needed to happen within the judiciary as a whole. For instance, you will see legislation presented this year concerning civil jurisdiction increases in the circuit court. That will have an impact on our courts. What kind of an impact, as the fiscal note indicated, we don't know for sure. This study will be done, if that jurisdiction changes, no matter what, this study will be done after the 1st of July when other changes in the laws have taken effect, and we know we are asking our circuit court clerks to do different processes, more processes, different requirements, what have you. So it's a study that we hope to do after the changes come July 1st.
Robin?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, one other thing that came into play a little bit that I didn't talk about, there are a lot of changes that we believe have occurred. One of them is an administrative order that came down from the Supreme Court. It was Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure 77D, which changed how we send out orders and added a more additional work to the clerk's load as well. That also wasn't measured, didn't become effective until July 1, and it was the culmination of this wherein I went to Joanne and said, we really need to do this study, and unfortunately, you know, it wasn't a year and a half ago or when we did our biennial budget.
Okay. I think it's, go ahead.
Explain the rule and what was the new requirement?
Robin?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, the rule basically was unclear as to exactly how the orders of the court are sent out. It said that the attorneys would provide copies of the proposed order and the documents to be sent to the attorneys and provide them to the clerk. It didn't speak to postage, and it didn't speak to exactly who was going to put those in the mail. We found that across the state, there were several different processes. Some clerks used boxes for attorneys. Some required the attorneys to provide the envelopes and the postage. It was very inconsistent, and so the court took this under advisement and studied it and decided that the orders were the work of the court and they should be sent out by the clerks. And they can request that the attorneys still provide those, but in the end, if the order isn't sent out, it's the clerk's responsibility.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Madam Chairman, it's just mostly for my edification. I just want to get an understanding of what the different courts are. I'm not an attorney, so I'm just, you know, the circuit court, what is their primary function and responsibilities, and then the district difference between them and the district court, and then obviously I would be under the understanding that Supreme Court, you know, that the appeals made to the Supreme Court from the, I guess I'm assuming the lower court, but I've never had an understanding of the difference between a circuit court and a district court for mine.
Madam Chairman. Just very briefly, and we'd be happy to visit with you, you know, one-on-one at any time that you would like to talk about the work of the various courts. But briefly, the district courts are our primary general jurisdiction trial courts. They handle essentially all kinds of cases, criminal and civil. They are a constitutional court. There's one in every judicial district, two or three sometimes judges in each judicial district. Approximately... 10 years ago, the circuit court system was put into place, and circuit courts handle the smaller cases. They handle misdemeanors and civil disputes less than $7,000. So they handle all the law enforcement citations and anything under $7,000 in dispute. We do have, and you'll be hearing about this during your session, a bill in place, a judiciary committee bill to increase that jurisdictional limit from 7,000 to 50,000, because that limit was set 15 years ago, and we're of the opinion that we can better utilize circuit courts if we can raise that civil jurisdiction up from what it is. But in essence, the district courts are the primary trial courts. The circuit courts handle the smaller matters, and all of these cases can be appealed to the Supreme Court.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Well, that just lended itself right into if we're doing a study of the workload for circuit courts with this $80,000, and then we have legislation in place to increase the amount, you know, that, you know, is referenced to a circuit court, then that in itself tells me that we're going to be increasing the workload of the circuit court. And is this study going to be timely as far as will we have that in place before we do the study? So will it, you know, be reflective of what then the true fact of what we're, you know, let's say, yep, the bill passes, sure, will it be reflective of what the court's going to be doing into the future?
Madam Chairman, I mean, that's a very good question. We intend to do, I'm going to let these two respond to the details of when this study would be completed, but our intent would be to have a baseline so we can measure what the increase in the jurisdictional level will do to the circuit court clerks. Am I correct, Rhonda?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Hastert, actually the timing of this, we want to wait 6 months because we believe if there's a jurisdiction change, it's going to go into effect July 1. And then we'll start training the clerks to do the study in January of next year and then actually do the time study in March so that we can study April and May, and then this study comes out with the new fiscal numbers July 1. We're also anticipating that not only is this jurisdiction change, if it occurs, is it going to change the workload for the clerks, but it will also change the workload for the judges as well. And so you might anticipate that there may be a request in the future for a judge's study, depending on what happens with the jurisdiction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many times in the past have we done specifically these studies? I know that you're doing the
the workload, the weighted workload studies quite often are yearly. But it looks like you've done the clerks, there's a four-year gap, 07 to 11 you're asking now, and now you're saying that for the judges you're going to be asking in the 2012, which would be about 6 years by my calculation. How often do we do these and what triggers it?
Madam Chairman, Representative Edmonds, across the nation, they typically do these studies about every 3 years. I know that Missouri does it every 3 years. We find that that's too often, that maybe there isn't as much legislative change and the processes in the courts don't change that quickly. We first did the judges study in 1999, and then I believe we did a new time study in 2007. But we've done some other minor changes, such as the drug court work, which isn't minute by minute. It's only those courts who have drug courts did we measure them. So we've done other tweaks in between. But typically 3 to 4 years is as long as you want to wait. We typically are on a 5 to 6 year. We've done the judges' time study twice since 1999. We've only studied the clerks once, and we did that first in 2005. In 2007, we adjusted for drug court stuff, but we're about 6 years out from the clerks' initial time study.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm used to seeing, I guess, when a bill is proposed and there's a fiscal note attached to it that shows administrative impact, does the Supreme Court participate in that process, and then maybe we could appropriate money attached to implementation of some certain legislation that affects how you run your office?
Joanne.
Madam Chairman, Representative Seward, yes, we do fiscal notes. We've already received the request for the fiscal note on the jurisdiction increase proposed legislation. We try to give as much information as possible. We don't anticipate coming back in the next biennium budget and asking for a circuit court clerk in every one of our circuit courts. If you look at this and use this as a tool, you can see down at the bottom line, the resources needed and how many we actually have. We have a percentage, or we have the actual amount. Most of our circuit courts are slightly overstaffed. If the civil jurisdiction level is increased, we don't anticipate that it's going to cause a shortage of a full position. We think we will be more on track with covering those additional processes. If there is a circuit court that we find after doing an updated time study, they are short at least one or more positions, then we will use those vacant positions that we have and allocate that position to the shortage. But we don't want to fill the vacancies that we have now, because we want to reserve those and keep those on hand in the event a new study indicates there is a shortage in a different particular area. We don't want to have a full-time position and then say, you know, riff someone and move that position. There was a position vacant in Warland just recently, and Teton County indicated they were more than one person overstaffed. We asked the clerks if anyone was interested in moving to Warland, and we actually had a clerk who was. So we will keep the vacancy in Jackson or Teton County vacant, and that position is now moved to Warland to fill a vacancy and a need in that particular circuit court. So we don't believe that we'll have to ask for additional personnel, but again, this is the perfect tool that we use and has been beneficial to us in the past, so that we don't have positions being wasted out there across the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps a follow-up, but I don't know if they're the ones to really answer this, but, I mean, are we doing this anywhere else in state government, these time studies for other agencies, providing a service, daily service based on caseload? I guess what I'm saying, this is the first time I've seen a request for a time study analysis.
Mr. Cox.
Can anyone answer that?
Richard?
Madam Chairman. Representative Seward, other agencies do time studies of their staff mainly to allocate employees' time between various federal programs, so that, for example, the best example is Family Services. They're social workers and their caseworkers keep track of their time as to whether they're working on a food stamp case, a TANF case, a social work type case, and that gives the department the ability and the information to be able to allocate the salaries for those positions to the various federal programs and draw the federal programs money down. So other state agencies do use time study systems. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Nicholas and then Representative Esquivel.
Thank you. I guess, you know, we have done time studies in various agencies, and oftentimes the studies are used as essentially the basis to come back and ask for more employment. So generally you begin to see an issue. The Highway Patrol does them often as a basis for trying to justify a new patrolman. That, incidentally, you do more patrolmen, increases their workload. And so, I mean, typically when you see these requests, it's on the edge of asking for more staff. Then there's time studies that we use for total quality management purposes to make sure that we're using our staff the best. We move people around. We don't fill vacancies when they are needed or not needed. And one of the aspects of the circuit court is that we've encouraged the court to begin to look where their caseloads are shifting and not fill vacancies when they're not needed. So it can be a tool not only for requesting more funds, but it's also a tool to defend to the circuit courts why you have a vacancy rate of seven positions. So if you save one position, then you've saved your $80,000 there, particularly for over biennium. So, and that vacancy and whether or not that, I mean, one of the issues, if you have a vacancy of, or maybe I should say that the 7.38, is that positions more than you need to hire or less, fewer positions than you need to perform the work test?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, that is seven positions. We have seven positions more than needed currently. And if you look at the numbers across the different districts, some of them are just very small percentages. Some of them are indicated as like half a person, three-quarters of a person, what have you.
I mean, we've authorized you then for positions that are 7.3 more than your study says that are required. And then if you have a vacancy, do you freeze that position until, if it's a, look at Teton County, 1.52, they almost have one and almost two people more than your study warrants. Do you say you can't fill that position, or what are you using the study for once you receive it?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, yes, and just recently Worland had a vacancy, and a clerk from Teton County decided to move to Worland to take a vacancy there of a clerk position that was necessary. So Teton currently is only 0.52 person overstaffed, and we will not fill that vacancy until we have more documentation that vacancy is needed there, or we will move that position to a different circuit court wherever the resources are needed.
Just to follow up for everybody, the district courts are constitutionally independent, so they have their own staff, and we go through each court. The circuit court is is unified, if you will, into the Supreme Court's budget. So we ask the Supreme Court to manage positions. So if we give them 125 authorized positions, and then we come back and say, well, you only need 117. And the question is, do you say, okay, we're going to start eliminating positions? Well, if you're in Teton County, believe me, if you eliminate two positions, you're going to hear from your clerks. So in one sense, you need this data as a management tool for the Supreme Court to know where to move clerks. If we're going to insist that they manage their clerks across their whole system, same thing with circuit court judges. If you find an area is needs an extra judge, fair enough, but what happens when you don't need a judge? Are you going to move the judge, or are you going to create the vacancy? So there is a unique aspect that we require them to manage, and to manage their budget, they need to know where these are and have a basis for shifting a position from Teton County to another county. And if the data is not reliable, then you're not going to be able to move a position. So to that extent, you could see savings on it. So it's a bit unique in that sense of trying to manage total positions. And when they come back, you know, we may say, you know, if you only get 120 positions. I mean, that's the way to regulate this and say you got 117. Okay, you're at 125. We'll only allow you to fill vacancies up to at a point that you fall below 117. Well, the problem with that is the vacancies may not occur where you need them to occur. The other aspect we might as well get out on the table because it's going to become important is I think you ought to explain to us all and refresh us with respect to the distinction when we start talking about cases being filed in the district court versus the circuit court. You have court filing fees. You've got electronic fees that we've allowed you to act or add to the court filing fees, and then you have the issue of fines and where they go. And we know that we're going to get some issues with respect to the district court clerks, but if you'd refresh us with respect to where do the court filing fees go for the respective courts, what about the electronic fees, and then finally, what happens to fines? Are they treated the same as in all courts? So as we move these cases around, what impacts are we going to see?
Well, Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I assume you're talking about if the jurisdictional limit changes. Yeah, and I didn't bring that document, but we have this district court clerks have done sort of a rough estimate of how many cases they think this would result in them in going from district court to circuit court, and it's about a third of the civil cases. I think that's right. It ranges in the small districts from about $7,000 worth of filing fees to, in the largest districts, about $25,000 that would move from the district court to the circuit court. So it's not a significant dollar figure. In terms of where the fees go, I'm not sure I'm going to be qualified to answer that. The fines won't change at all. They'll go in the same direction. Where the court filing fees go, I'm not sure if that'll change or not, Rhonda. And Madam Chairman,
Mr. Co-Chair. Basically, the filing fees in the circuit court go to the state. So there's $30 for a filing fee to file a civil case in the circuit court. Ten of that, is it 40 now? It's 40 now. Sorry, excuse me. 40 now. The civil legal services fee is $10 of that. $10 of that is a court automation fee. And both of those fees go into separate earmarked funds, one for court automation, which funds some of the automation products projects for the judiciary. And we now have a civil legal services fee, which is $10, and it goes for, it's going to go for civil legal services for the indigent. And we're excited that the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid has a board now, and it's going to be up and running soon, and that's very exciting. But in the district court, so the other $20 goes to the state general fund, I believe. In the district court, $10 goes to court automation, $10 goes to civil legal services fee, and then the other $50, because it's a $70 filing fee, goes to the counties. And that's why this becomes a little bit of an issue, because the district court clerks perceive that they're going to lose those $50 filing fees going to their county if you shift the jurisdiction and you shift their collection cases from the district court into the circuit court. Now, although it's going to be a third of the civil caseload, they believe, it's only about 10 or 12% of the entire workload of the district court. So their civil cases are a smaller portion than the rest of it. So I hope that answers your question. If not, go ahead.
I mean, when it comes to the circuit court clerical staff, we pay for it at the state. When it's the district court and the clerks and their staff paid for by the counties. When it comes to the circuit court judges, we pay for the judges, their offices, their computers, their staffs, but we don't pay for the facilities. We expect the counties to provide the facilities. And when you go to the district court, we pay for the judges, their judicial assistants, their staff, and their computers, that sort of thing, but expect the counties to provide the facility resources. Mm-hmm. Right? Did I get that right?
Good job. You pass. Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. How much did we spend on this study back in 2007? Was it the same consultant that we used back then that we'll be using now?
Robin.
Madam Chairman, Representative Esquivel, we did use the same consultant. And in the 2007 study, which we studied the judges, it was $100,000 is what she charges for that study. This one is a little different. The clerks are different. They do different kinds of work. I think they're the process is, and I'm not exactly sure. I mean, she's a PhD statistician. I don't know how it all goes in, but calculating the minutes and all of that, when we did it in 2007, I believe the appropriation was $100,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have a follow-up?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, great. All right. Representative Edmonds.
Just one more question on the I understand that we're using this as a tool, but I guess my question is, how effective is the tool? So, for instance, when we have these numbers, you use the example of Worland. I assume that the question to the clerk in Teton County was a voluntary request to move. If they don't move, they don't move. Is that correct? I mean, how effectively can you use this tool to move staff?
Joanne?
Madam Chairman, Representative Evans, we do not ask for anyone to resign their position if their particular circuit court is overstaffed. We had the opportunity of a circuit court clerk who lived in Teton County and did want to move out. We were aware of it. When we have a vacancy, we put it out, announce it to all of our circuit court clerks first, and if anyone is interested in moving to a different county or circuit court where there is a vacancy, they have priority. This particular position worked out well for us, and so we did not have to let anyone go. But we do it on attrition. We don't ask to have somebody resign or anything. And that's it. Again, it is a tool for us because I can tell you, even hearing some of the discussion of the upcoming legislation, I have circuit court clerks calling all of the time and thinking, what are you doing to us? What are you doing to us? Every one of them would come to us asking for additional clerks. And we don't have anything to say, well, we realize your statistics are up, but do you really need to have that additional position? So, again, this is what we go to when we say, no, we're sorry. Based on the study, you will not be getting another circuit court clerk. And they're good with it. Well, at least we can show them documentation.
Robin?
Madam Chair, Representative Edmonds, one thing I would add is it's not an exact science. I mean, I wouldn't say that this is to the 10th degree accurate, but what it does is it measures the courts the same across the board. And so when you have a court that comes and says, oh, we need a clerk, we need a clerk, this sort of goes to Mr. Co-Chair's question earlier. What we say is the filings in your court, as compared to the rest of the state, don't justify us giving you a position. And it gives us the opportunity to step in and say, are there some processes that you do that we can help you be more efficient with? And so, although I don't think it's to the nth degree accurate, it gives us an idea, and it allows us to compare the courts to other courts across the state.
Okay, go for it.
All right, here's the heavy question. If we give you the $80,000, what if we footnote your budget to provide that no vacancies would be filled in those agencies, those districts that have greater than one until you get a new study? So you've got Lincoln County, 1.43. You've got Platte County, 1.29. And you have Teton County, 1.52. So that, in effect, we would say there's three vacancies that become unfillable until you get a new study and show that there's justification in the event that there's a resignation or a vacancy.
Joanne.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, obviously we would not care for a footnote like that because it controls us a little bit too tight. But on the other hand, the justices have also made that determination. When Holly Hansen was State Court Administrator, we went to them and
specifically asked, what do you want us to do if there is a shortfall of more than a half a person? They decided that we would not come to you unless it was a full position short. And so that's why, again, we've asked the justices to direct how we fill these vacancies. But if that's the only way we can get this time study moving forward, we obviously, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, will agree to that.
Well, I guess my thought is that having the studies is great. And if we use a tool both to manage when we need to give you new positions, but also that we could see an impact that if you're overstaffed, that you won't fill the vacancies. And then the question is you say, great, we have a vacancy in Teton County, now we can shift it to someplace. Well, if you shift it over to somebody that's a minus 30, a point 30, so that now they go from a minus 30 to a plus 70, perhaps we'd like to have a say in that. Maybe they ought to live with minus 30 and maybe have a minus 6 threshold. But it does seem to me that where you're 7.5 overfunded, if we'd have been sitting here at when we had a 5% reduction enforced not too long ago, we would have said, look, there's seven positions that we're not asking you to fire anybody, but we would ask you that when those vacancies occur, not to replace them. Now, I understand that it's not as though all those, if you have a .18 overage in one county, that doesn't mean that you can either eliminate nor should you add if it's minus .18. But on balance, you've got about seven, you know, if you say half of those positions, three of them should be eliminated in the absence of a new study justifying the seven. I mean, and maybe what you come back and say, well, I understand what you're also saying is, well, we've got a 7.38 capacity to absorb more workload if we shift caseload jurisdiction. Having said that, I assume that the district clerks, that seven people are out hired in the county because if you're going to shift your caseload and ultimately absorb that seven employee, you're going to make them busy system-wide. Then I would assume that there'd be a corresponding reduction in the counties, and I suppose they can deal with that staffage. But ultimately, studies are great, but they ought to be worked both ways, and we ought to get a benefit of the taxpayer, ought to get another benefit, and that is, where is the demonstrated overage that we don't fill those positions?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I really think that is consistent with our intent. This is a moving target. We've got all this electronic filing coming into place. I mean, maybe I'm being Pollyanna here, but I'm really hopeful that's going to have a big impact on reducing our workload. If we get the payment, automatic electronic payment that we're talking about, in some of these districts, it takes one person full-time to do nothing but input citations by hand. And when that changes, it's going to change dramatically. So, I think we're very consistent with your intent. Whether that makes sense to put it in a hard and fast budget footnote when we know these are a little bit loosey-goosey might not be the right term, but they're not finite in terms of accuracy. So I think we'd suggest that you not go to that length, but I don't think there's any disagreement with the intent that you've expressed.
You good, Rhonda?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, I think that wraps things up for you.
Thank you all very much.
We'll have the district court. Is Mr. Campbell going to present for that?
I believe Judge Campbell is next, and thank you all, and welcome all the new members to this committee, although maybe it's condolences instead of welcoming. But
well,
thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Judge Campbell.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman.
You might explain how you represent and your role in presenting the budget.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm Tom Campbell. I'm one of three district court judges in the First Judicial District. That's, of course, Cheyenne, Laramie County. I would start by explaining and sharing the regrets of Judge Arnold, Peter Arnold, and Michael Davis, my colleagues, both of whom are doing what they're paid to do, and just couldn't make arrangements as I was able to. So I'm the voice of the First Judicial District as to these couple of requests today.
Joanne.
Madam Chairman, Joanne Odendahl from the Supreme Court. I do assist the district court judges in implementing or putting together their budget request. If you turn to page 6 under the district court section, there is a budget request for the First Judicial District, $54,000 for salaries and a part-time position. Currently, District 1A and 1B share one law clerk, and Judge Campbell will explain the need for this. I will explain the financial part of this, but basically they currently share one law clerk. They are asking for an additional law clerk, so that would increase each of their budgets by one half person. In order to do that, we've asked for a salary of $54,000 and benefits of $19,936. This would, we hope, start immediately. We hope that they don't have to wait till July 1, but if necessary, I believe they're willing to do that. That
for 18 months or for 1 year?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, basically the $54,000 is for 1 year. That is the starting salary of a law clerk who has passed the Wyoming State Bar. The additional funds that they have currently in their budget, because they are sharing that position, that will help make up the difference if you are able to allow them to hire a new person as soon as possible.
The final number would be 146 for each court and times two, so you're at, that'll come about $292,000 for, if it was a front end of the biennium, it would require $292 to fund it.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, if you turn to page 7, we do have a worksheet there that indicates the full biennium request that you will see in the next biennium budget for the 2013-2014 biennium. The full amount would be $147,000 approximately that would cover the benefits and salary. Right now, each of them in their budget has approximately $73,000. So together, it would increase by $147,000. Together, they would increase. Because to just finish this biennium, they each need
$73,000.
For the biennium.
$295,000.
The biennial amount would be the 147 plus the 194, right?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, the biennial amount for each district court would be $147,000.
But you take off the 73 and 97. I got you.
Okay.
So it'd be 100. I got you. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Von Plater.
Thank you. My question is, there is one person being used half-time between two courts. Is that correct?
May I?
Yeah. Judge Campbell.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, and Senator Von Plater, and if I could just describe that work, because it is sort of a lead into what we were asking for. This is just a historical evolution of the law clerk and staff and judge environment. About 9 years ago, this body added a judge to the judicial district here in Cheyenne, didn't add a clerk. There were two clerks, in other words, two paid staff attorneys that split their work amongst three. For budget purposes, it is exactly as it has been described to you, of course, 1A, 1B, and 1C, myself, Judge Davis, and Judge Arnold. But in the working world, and this is one of the complications of it all, there's just two staff attorneys, and you catch as catch can, and you work with it. So they literally, in terms of, there's really no direct, I suppose, accountability except to all three of us. And it's that's a smaller problem, but it's certainly a management issue. Not knowing, dividing the work up is very, very difficult, of course, as well, practically. But it is two full-time, hired out of law school, so to speak. They passed the bar in that summer, and they work for 2 years. That's written nowhere, but it's the tradition, and that's the circumstances now. We might stagger, hire one for 1 year and one for two, or however, or maybe a third one, and sort of stagger them. The budget amounts would always be the same, but the idea is that we're asking that these two budgets that are now funding halftime, but really just allowing us to share two lawyers, staff members, be expanded to three, so that there are there's first the accountability, as I think everybody understands it, many of you better than me, of having a direct employee member, and then the workload itself. Judges spend, and I'm not sure which side of the fence you're on about whether you think judges should be in the courtroom or not in the courtroom working, but that's what we do. And as the writing requirements in particular is where law clerks help you, what they do effectively is research, prepare you for the hearings you go in on. Depending on the kind of hearing it is beforehand, they prepare you to write the decision that you're now required to make once you've had the hearing. This can be, you know, a four-day trial. It can be a 30-minute argument on something called summary judgment. Whatever the length of it is, judges, more so than ever in history, are required to write, that is, formulate a written opinion that cites the law, applies the law, and says what they're doing. It is not an old notion to say judges just rule from the bench and say, counsel, your client wins, and off you go. But it's fading into history, even in child custody and more recently even in child support matters. Written opinions by the court are necessary to meet the standards of the law. So you need help, and you can do it yourself. We do it ourselves. But when you're doing that yourself, you're not in the courtroom. And it's really the if you want to think of it another way, it's an extension of the judicial resource to have that staff member. If I have to stop, read, write, and study everything myself, any of us, we're in the circumstance where we cannot be in the hearings. Certainly lawyers would tell you the premium they put on the judicial service, some of them like it if we write brilliant opinions. Mostly they want an answer from us as soon as they can get an answer from us, and that's fair, but they want their hearings. And it is the tension of those two jobs that we do, or those two roles we have, that leads to the necessity of having these staff members, law clerks. I would say as a final sort of descriptive matter, and really what motivated us to come in here sort of halfway through the budget, is we have different parts of that docket that's been described to you already a little bit, and one of them is the appellate docket. While the Wyoming Supreme Court is sort of the final appellate court, we act as an appellate court. That is review, sometimes voluminous records, of administrative agencies and of the circuit court. In other words, a criminal case in the circuit court is appealed to us. And when this happens, it is, just as in the Supreme Court, an entire review of the record, a review of the law, sometimes, but not always, oral argument. What has happened to the appellate docket here, certainly through no fault of our intent and our effort, is that it has languished. And our appellate docket here in Laramie County, although I think we've made admirable efforts this last year or so, even writing on our own, studying records on our own, has, I guess I don't want to be any stronger than language, but we're way further behind than many of our colleagues. And it was that sort of motivated us. We have done what we can. We've, in fact, we're taking on externs, they call them, from the law school, non-lawyers, but they want to be. To do certain sorts of work for us, some relief in the appellate docket. In Cheyenne, that's if you saw our workload study, you'd see we don't do that many more appeals maybe than some other judges. But we do get administrative agency appeals, DEQ, Secretary of State, things like that that are fairly complex, and we've just hit a wall. And rather than wait, to try to alleviate that problem, and, of course, to spread the work out so it's evenly done and that resource is available to all three of us, we've decided to make this request. So that's sort of my description of the work and the need, right. And thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that helps. Go ahead, Co-Chairman Nicholas.
Thank you. I guess a couple things. With respect to the you might explain the District Court Budget Review Committee and how that works, and it's made a positive recommendation for these.
The in furtherance of this long-standing cooperation, and Joanne can describe it a little better also, but and furtherance of this sort of long-standing cooperation that the budgets are funneled through the Supreme Court budget, and Joanne, of course, is the resource for that, we review our own. Although we're separate sort of freestanding entities, we form a committee that our conference votes on. The members of that committee receive large or small, many or few requests before they are presented to the Supreme Court for inclusion in the budget. This request and the one that Joanne will also tell you about that Judge Arnold's made about his replacing his broken copier were run by that committee. But as to any comments they would have made other than that do pass or recommendation, I'm not aware of those. But Joanne, if you could help.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, the district court judges agreed a long time ago that all of the budgets, to be somewhat consistent, would go through this budget review committee. It's normally the outgoing president of their judicial council, the current president, and the president-elect. They review, especially in a biennium budget, they review all of their requests. All of the district courts come together. I do a big spreadsheet so they can review. If someone's asking for an astronomical amount, a lot extra money for, I don't know, overhead or something, the judge's review committee actually calls that judge and say, explain this to me. How do you expect me to defend this on the at the JAC hearing? You explain it to me, and then the committee decides, well, maybe that's a little extravagant, and they, actually ask the particular judge maybe not to ask for it. So it does go through a review committee. That is the same for the circuit judges, and then the Supreme Court has the final say over the circuit judges' budgets. But the district court judges do come together. They try to be consistent throughout the state. I would like to add that there is only one other district that shares a law clerk, and that is in Judicial District 8. The judge in Converse County, Douglas, shares a law clerk with the judge in Torrington or Goshen County. And otherwise, every judge has their own law clerk.
With respect to if we decide to set the precedent that we're going to have a one-to-one ratio, one clerk for every judge, what's the implication statewide? How many judges out there do not have a full-time law clerk?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, we currently have one district, District 8, that two judges share one law clerk. That is Judge Brooks in Converse County and Judge Couts in Goshen County. And basically, because of their workload, I don't anticipate them coming and asking for an additional part-time to each have their own, but at this time I can't guarantee it.
They're the last court then without a full-time clerk.
That is correct.
Per judge. And then with respect to the, suppose the legislature does approve the caseload shift, will there be a reduction in the district court workload such that they don't need the law clerk? Of course, I know the answer is you always need your law clerk. But,
yeah.
But we might as well talk about it.
Well, I could describe the answer. Of course, that is the answer, Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman. The answer is we need them for all the things that we do and the ones I've described. The change, not to go down the road of advocating at all one way or the other, I speak for myself only, but the observation I would make about that change is that the dollar amounts being discussed are the kind and nature of cases for which you are using hearing time, but they are very largely judgment and paperwork cases, if I could use that expression, but cases that do not utilize the law clerk resource or require writing. These are a huge percentage of them, in fact, are collection cases where people don't answer and default. The ones that I have tried and I've sort of been watching recently are fairly direct, sort of one-witness type cases. So they use some hearing time, but they don't use this research or research time to any great extent. So that's just my reflection on it is not a great change in that, and to the extent you transfer the resource, be it by changing our caseload or by changing the amount of time I spend in the courtroom on anything, by having a law clerk, it is to the same result as far as we're concerned. It extends the judicial resource, and I don't mean to fall back on this old caseload study, and I know that's been discussed, but the caseload study has long said the jurisdiction needed more. We've modified this. I think some of you know we actually had an additional resource, and it was me. As a circuit court judge for many years, I had a portion, the post-divorce docket, they call it, people coming in after the divorce fighting over whether something was paid and a change of custody and things like that, and you would sort of portion that out. Well, that has gone by the wayside. The circuit court uses all their resources now and not a half of a resource upstairs, and conversely, we've absorbed the entire district court docket, including that portion that was handled for 8 years by someone else. So it's built up. It takes time, and I think I've explained the rest of the request, but I don't think the jurisdictional change will have a tremendous impact on our need for the clerk as I've described it.
And Judge Campbell, I was thinking that at some point previously we'd had sort of a docket review of how long it was taking in Laramie County, for example, for a case to be done.
Yes, Madam Chairman and Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee, I'm proud to say they did that. They took a little snapshot review work study of just a civil, without the appellate, without the criminal, but just a civil doc, without the domestic, and did a review of it, a miniature, I call it a snapshot. Joanne or Rhonda, of course, who acquired that service, can tell you more. But we've reviewed it, and we're doing very well keeping up in the entire civil docket. And I have a feeling it's the same as to most of the domestic relations docket and so forth. In other words, things are not languishing too long. The place where the trouble has come, of course, is the use of judge time, you know, in the courtroom as opposed to research and the appellate docket. So, yes, we're very proud to say, since you brought it up, that we're doing very well keeping up in that regard. Thank you.
Good. All right. And did you want to mention about the copier? I mean, I think everyone read about that it's all broken down, Joanne, but if we want to finish this up officially.
Yes. Judge Arnold asked me if I could weep during the presentation.
Okay.
No.
Ready, go now.
No. I beg your pardon, please.
Yes, Madam Chairman, on the District Court section, page 20, there is a request from Judge Arnold here in Judicial District 1C for $7,000 to purchase a new copier. This is a one-time request.
It's better than Stephen's budget request.
Madam Chairman, could we get, if you have some updated information on what your caseload is, filings for all the courts, and showing what your length of trial, your docket period is, so we could actually see that. If you just supply that to us, we'll put it in our files.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, are you wanting both circuit and district courts? Okay.
Any other questions of the committee? Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
All right. I think we need to go back on the floor and see what's happening. Tomorrow afternoon, 3 p.m., for School Facilities Commission in the Hirschler.
Oh, wait a minute. Tomorrow, that's a public hearing, not a budget, or is that the public hearing on a bill?
That's the public hearing on School Facilities Commission,
in Hirschler. Wait a minute.
In Hirschler.
Do we have a bill that we still have to do a public hearing on? It's a bill hearing. Are we combining? I think we're combining Are we combining a bill that we have to have public hearing on along with a budget exercise to find out what their facilities budget is going to look like?
No, Mr. Co-Chairman, it's just the bill.
When are we going to – so that's just the bill. Are we bringing them back in to talk about CAPCON?
Right, next week.
Okay. Fair enough. So tomorrow is just the bill.
Right. Next week on January 18th, School Facilities Commission meets at 1
now,
in here.
Now, with respect to the staff, if we could – would we have a hearing the following day? Is if you could give us – the agencies appearing, and have the agencies call over and tell us who's going to be appear, get their names, so that folks have a cheat sheet on who's there and what their names are, and so we know who they are.
Madam Chair. Just thank you, Madam Chairman. Just if you would, for my edification on our process here, And we just heard the testimony of this agency. Are we then? What's the whole process? Are we voting on at some point the supplemental as a whole?
Yeah.
We don't vote on each separate. Okay.
We're going to let Senator Nicholas will just
what's
explain
gonna happen
the process
is this.
Here.
When we go through the markup process, we're going to go each one of these requests item per item. So today would be 5 items. We'll go through every budget. Now, in the executive branch, the vote on the floor is governor's recommendation. So if you vote